Okay, so I'm going to be talking about mining the auditory brain. So mining is just a fancy word for data analysis, but it puts the emphasis on the intention to go deep. So whereas other people are content to remain near the surface, I think there's a lot to be found deep, hidden deep within the data that we record from the brain. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on. So I'll be talking about three things. So to put all of this in perspective and show a bit of the motivation of what's behind this work, I'm going to say a few words about the COCOHA project. Somebody else has mentioned it earlier. It's a project that myself, Shihab, and Daniel are involved in, and Malcolm, with the help of Malcolm as an advisor. Then I'll talk specifically about one aspect of the project that involves decoding jointly the auditory stimulus and the brain signals. And then I'll say more about where all this could go in terms of techniques to mine the brain. So the COCOHA project, it's a European project over 4 years, starting in 2015, meaning it's almost finished. There's a website that gives some information. The aim is to design what we call a cognitively controlled hearing aid. So the need for this is described in this curve. So on this axis, you have age. This axis is the percent of people who are technically impaired. I mean, they have measurably impaired. The thresholds are elevated by some criterion, I forget what. So overall, there's about 5 to 7% of the whole population. That means about 50 million in Europe. I forget how many in the States. And it's something that increases really, really rapidly beyond about 60 years.
So what's the criteria by which that 5 to 7%?
Threshold elevation by, I don't know, I forget what it is, 20, 40 dB, I forget the exact criterion. Life expectancy is increasing, so it's becoming more and more of a problem. So
to follow up on that, so that percent impaired that reflects sensory neural hearing loss, as assessed by PDA, or also other things potentially?
Potentially, I mean, it doesn't discriminate between that. So it means that it's something that, I mean, each of us has more than 50% chance of running into the problem of debilitating hearing loss before we are deceased. So first deaf, then dead, that order. So in addition to people who are technically, objectively impaired, there are people who just, I mean, like many of us, certainly me, who have difficulty hearing in noisy environments. So on this axis here is a signal-to-noise ratio, intelligibility. This curve here is for a young chick, a normal person, somebody with normal, fresh ears. This is somebody with normal hearing, but maybe more aged or would listen to too much rock music or whatever. I worked in a metal factory. Signal-to-noise ratios that would be perfectly tolerable for this person are completely intolerable for the aged person, despite the fact that technically they're not deaf, they're not impaired. So that's called hidden hearing loss, and it affects an enormous proportion of the population. So the problem here is not so much loss of sensitivity, it's loss of the ability to deal with low signal to noise ratio. So loss of sensitivity, well, people have invented hearing aids. They're very effective. Basically, what they do is that they crank up your threshold of hearing. You have you're impaired in this frequency region. Crank up the gain. Works very well, but it does not improve signal to noise ratio. Because if there's noise in this region, well, it's cranked up together with the signal. So there are many solutions to the signal to noise ratio problem. Some are really simple. Some are more complex. You have noise reduction algorithms, directional microphones, remote microphones, and so on. So many of these exist, and you can expect that more will come with technical progress because there are new algorithms being developed, new hardware like MEMS, what is it, micro, or micro machined, anyhow, it's a new technology for miniaturized microphones. They're new concepts, hearable, wearable. I mean, there's a flurry of activity, and the development of smartphones means that each of us carries a device in his or her pocket, with that is a powerful computer, often with several microphones on it. So, I mean, the landscape is changing quickly. There is always going to remain a problem, and that is control. So suppose that you're in a noisy environment, there are many sources, many people speaking, you'd like to hear one person, but other people are speaking. How is the device going to decide which person you want to hear and which person you don't? If you make a mistake, well, it's better not to have the device. So there are many solutions to that. You can have smart things that guess what you want to hear. You can just move the device or point it. You could have a little graphic or haptic interface in your hand. The solution that we're looking at is cognitive control, meaning the derived signals directly from the brain. And that leads us to that's the basis of the COCOHA project that we managed to sell to the funders. So the basically it's based on three modules here. So you have acoustic scene analysis. So it's the best that you can do with multiple microphones and deep learning and everything you have available to separate sources that are mixed together in the environment. Second is a module that chooses among the various possibilities that this guy can come up with. So if there are 10 people in the room, this thing will pull out 10 signals, 10 candidate signals, and you want to be able to choose among them. This guy makes a choice and sends the information, sends the audio to your ears. It also takes the EEG, so it makes a decision based on signals derived from your brain. That's the ambition. So there are lots of reasons to be skeptical. For one, anybody who's worked with this kind of signal, we're not going to have invasive electrodes, so it's going to be from the skin, outside the scalp, and outside the cranium. The signals are really noisy. It's hard to imagine, even if you're deaf, completely deaf, accepting to run or walk around with one of these things on your head. There are lots of, if you want to make it work and have it produced by a company, there are many constraints. Size, power consumption, cost, producibility, usability, aesthetics, marketing, and so on. So these are major obstacles. Reasons to be optimistic, well, technical progress, as I mentioned, size, cost, and power constraints, all of this is getting better. Deregulation, it's an important point because currently hearing aids are highly regulated, meaning that you can't come up with a new device and sell it. You have to go through a whole bunch of constraints, regulations. These are disappearing. I mean, they started disappearing seriously under the Obama administration, and now, it's anybody's guess what's going to happen now. Rise of this hearables concept. So you have, up till now, a hearing aid was a device was something for hearing impaired. So if something is wrong with your ears, you get a hearing aid. Now, with the notion of hearables, a hearable is something that anybody might want to buy, either because it's cool or because it helps you in some way. For example, if you're in a busy meeting and the acoustics are bad and you'd like to hear what other people are saying and you struggle, well, it might be useful to buy one of these off-the-shelf hearable devices. That brings that erases the distinction between normal and impaired. And of course, another factor is the entry of smartphone companies such as Samsung, who have an enormous patent portfolio, Apple, and so on. Okay, so just as a metaphor of what we're trying to do, this is a schematic of the healthy auditory system. So you have the cochlea that many people have been talking about, inner hair cells, outer hair cells. The signals go up through a chain of cochlear nucleus and so on up to the cortex. And of course, there are lots of pathways going back down to the... So this is in the healthy system. So in the impaired system, this part here is damaged. And what we have available to alleviate this damage is the hearing aid. So that's something that's going to alleviate the, it's going to repair the part, the pathway that goes up, but it can't restore the pathway going down. That part is missing. And so you could say that what we're trying to do is in some sense conceptually equivalent to restoring the efferent pathway that is lost in this case.
Hold on.
Yes?
I think Tobias also alluded to the idea that the efferent pathway to the cochlea might play a role in selective attention. Is there really any evidence for that at all? I mean, is there physiology suggesting it's specific enough to really enhance the signal?
I don't think there's any evidence that it is capable of, for example, selecting one voice among several.
Okay.
Not at that level. What it is very likely capable of doing is tuning the operating point at this level to maximize your ability to perform this task.
We have produced some experiments and published in Physical Review Applied in the first issue where we did exactly this. And it's possible to separate musical instruments that operate together.
What were the experiments? Meaning you made measurements from a in vivo copy.
Yeah. No. We have the whole model of the cochlea,
right,
which has inherently this efferent stimuli pathway, which is the whole amplifier, the whole parameter, and we model the.
Right. So I can imagine in theory how it might happen, but I was wondering if there was any.
You can make a comparison of the effect that you have in this whole cochlea with what has been measured in terms of level shifts in the real biological cochlea on day.
Anyhow, that's not the major point. I'm using this as a metaphor of what we're trying to do. So, second part of my talk is actually doing the decoding part, where you take signals from the brain and acoustic stimuli. So, in auditory neuroscience, typically an experiment looks like this. You present a stimulus to the ears of the subject, and you record an electrical response from their scalp. And based on the knowledge of the stimulus and measurement of the response, you try to infer how perceptual mechanisms work. And there's, I mean, countless papers have been. So basically what you see is something that looks like this. So here's a time axis. Actually, it's a more or less logarithmic axis to compress all the different aspects of the waveform in a single graph. And what you see is basically a squiggle, I mean, a bunch of squiggles. And so based on the amplitudes and the positions of these squiggles, there are thousands of papers making inferences on what is going on within the brain. So this is very, very nice. Problem is that you, in order to get these, because of the signal-to-noise ratio, the poor signal-to-noise ratio, you need to repeat the stimulus many times, and you have to average over repetitions, which means that you can't use, it won't work for continuous stimulation. For example, speech, it won't be very useful. So the stuff that we really care about, which is how we hear the world, there are limitations on how you can study it. So a new approach has been gaining momentum over the last few years, which is based on system identification or decoding. So basically you have an ongoing stimulus here, you record the brain response, and using the appropriate type of algorithms, you try to determine the properties of the system. Usually it's a linear system. And there are tons of papers that have come out. Nima Mesgarani, Nyding. Well, Jonathan Simon, who talked last week, is one of the major players, and so on. So there are essentially two flavors to this kind of work. One is based on a forward model, and the other is based on a backward model. So the forward model, you take the stimulus and you try to find a linear model that is going to predict the EEG. With the backward model, which is also called stimulus reconstruction, you go the other way. You take the EEG, you find a linear model that can post-dict the stimulus, or reconstruct, quote-unquote, the stimulus. So forward models, you take the audio. It's not really the audio. You have to derive features first. Like, it could be just the waveform envelope, or it could be a spectrogram representation, or it could even could potentially be something more sophisticated. And you predict the EEG, and it looks like this. So here, for example, if your feature is the acoustic envelope, you're going to fit a model like this. So you express the EEG at time t as a weighted sum of samples of this envelope in the past. And the solution to this gives you an FIR filter. If you're working with a spectrogram, it's exactly the same thing, except that your filter here is going to be a multi-channel FIR filter. So you're expressing each channel, so here, expressing each channel of the EEG as a weighted sum of different channels of your spectrogram, so different frequency bands of your frequency channels of your spectrogram at different points in the past. So this is the sort of result that you get. So the model that you find can be described by this thing here. So it's what they call a temporal response function, or a spectrotemporal response function. The S is hidden. And the prediction that you get looks like this. So if you're a believer, you'll agree with me that the red thing looks, the blue thing looks like the red thing. So the red is the EEG, and the blue is the best approximation, best prediction that you can make based on the stimulus of what this guy looks like. So the other method, the backward model, it's essentially the same, except that it works in the other direction. So here's the acoustic envelope. You're going to express the acoustic envelope at some time in the past here as a weighted sum of EEG channels. Or in the case of a spectrogram, you're going to do the same. And here it's going to give you a multi-channel spatiotemporal FIR filter. So multi-channel because you're post-dicting multiple frequency channels, and spatiotemporal because you're mixing samples from your EEG grid at different places in space and different points in time. And this is the sort of thing you get. So for an envelope, so this is the this would be the shape of the filter. So the different colors are for different conditions. I forget exactly the details. Or spectrograms. Here's I think Jonathan Simon showed these data. The data from a paper by Mesgarani and Chang. But in this case, they used this is derived from ECOG data, which is much cleaner, and so the results are much more spectacular than what we can hope to get with EEG. So the limitations of these two approaches are similar, in that if you look at the coefficients that you get, they're pretty small. So here on this axis, it's just subjects ordered by in terms of increasing correlation coefficient. This is correlation. It maxes out at about 0.1. So this was with the forward model, I think. Well, I forget. Anyhow.
Did you ever try the noise correct?
Noise correct.
Like normalized by the test reliability.
That's. I mean, not when we try to measure the core. Relation? No, we don't try to use that technique. Maybe we can talk about that.
Do you limit yourself to measuring correlation only for the frequencies that are actually present in the speech envelope?
So when you perform this type of experiment, generally you low pass filter the speech envelope and you low pass filter the the EEG, yeah, and that increases the degree of correlation. So in studies like this, they just choose a particular value. In a couple of slides, I'll show you a technique to make it do a better job of that. And so in terms of classification, so if we go back to the application, for example, COCOHA, we want to be able to make a decision. We want the device to make a reliable decision as to whether I attend to this voice or that voice. We want to minimize the errors. So here on this axis, this axis here is the duration of the data over which we're calculating the model. And this axis here is correct classification. So you can see that, at least for if you want a rapid response, you can only use a small amount of data. In that case, you won't get very high scores, and that's a problem.
But also, these models need to be trained on a lot of data first, right? Before then,
it won't help that much, because they're very simple models. There are very few parameters. You don't need that much more data to train them.
So you said one could train that model on 1 minute of data, and then.
So in order to get a reliable decision, you need. It's not only the training, but even when you're in the. After training, when you apply the learnt model, you still need a certain duration of data in order to get a reliable response because of the level of noise.
But what I mean is, so you need, say, whatever, half a minute in order to make a reliable estimate, but also you need even more data
in order to train that model,
then run it on that.
But you can imagine that your system is sort of working all the time and learning things. So the fact that we get poor correlation it shouldn't surprise us at all, because most of the activity within our brain has nothing to do with the sound that comes in our ears. I mean, our brain is doing tons of other stuff. So it's a little bit silly to expect that we'd get high correlation here. And in the same way, many aspects of the sound, many features of the sound, don't really change our percept that much. And even if it did change, it's pretty unlikely to be reflected in these squiggles that we can measure from the brain.
So this is interesting, and also we see this in this brainstorm work that I showed, right, on EEG work, that there's such a variation across subjects in terms
of.
I never know, like, really, like, apart from whatever skin conductances or anatomic differences, what's your feeling, like, where does that come from?
It could also come from the quality of the data recorded, and the presence of artifacts and stuff like that, which may occur with one subject, and you're lucky with the next. So a third way of doing it is to use what is called canonical correlation analysis, which was first proposed by Hotelling in 1936. So the idea in our context is we're going to be taking, instead of transforming the audio and predicting the EEG or vice versa, we transform both to a common space here, and we do the matching in this common space. So in terms of equations, so the forward model would look like this. So we're predicting the EEG based on the envelope or the signal. Backward model, we're post-predicting the stimulus based on the EEG. Here we're doing both at the same time. So we have to find both sets of coefficients. So and that's what CCA does, essentially. So it finds an optimal transform, an optimal set of coefficients to apply to the stimulus and to apply to the EEG in order to get signals that are not the same, but they are as close as possible in terms of correlation.
Both of these are linear, right?
Yeah. They're linear and they're also orthogonal.
So your equations, it's not clear what the ranges of the N and the K are and why that first one only has one sum.
Oh, yeah, it's a typo. Sorry, it's a... So this...
Are those the same? Up to some order or something?
Okay, so this guy has two sums because there are channels. There's a channel dimension, whereas here you have just an envelope. If instead of the envelope we had a spectrogram...
And these things you're computing are functions only of time. There's scalar functions of time. They're not multidimensional.
These, actually, they're multiple components. So indeed, it is multidimensional. the number of dimensions.
Why can't you put A into B? Why can't you make it separate?
This
one,
I'm
also
trying to see if
It's because, so you have two different spaces. You have the space of the stimulus and its transforms, so essentially the waveform envelope and the time-shifted waveform envelope. So you have multiple channels derived from your stimulus. You could include also spectrogram channels and stuff like that. So this is the first space. Second space is your EEG and potentially transforms of your EEG, like time shifts and stuff like that. So you need two transforms to bring them into some common, I mean, is that sufficient as an explanation, or do you need more?
I think intuitively it's not so different from low-pass filtering both the sound, that waveform, and the EEG before you compare them.
We'll get to that. It's more like bandpass.
If you just compute a correlation between the low-pass filtered envelope signal and the EEG that still has a bunch of high-frequency stuff in it, the correlation will be lower than it would be if you low-pass filter the EEG signal first.
CCA is doing that. So CCA here is doing that automatically. It's doing a little bit more than that.
Yeah, no, in a much more principled way. I'm just trying to explain.
So here, maybe this may help. I don't know if it's going to really help. So CCA in some ways is very much like PCA. So we had a great explanation of PCA this morning. It's a transform that takes your multidimensional data and orthogonalizes it, rotated in such a way that the first principal component has the maximum variance. So it's your linear transform of your data that gives the maximum amount of variance, and then the other components are orthogonal to the first with decreasing amounts of variance. So PCA cares about variance. CCA is a similar transform that produces orthogonal components. But there are two of them, the two transforms. One is applied to your first set, and the other is applied to your second set. Whereas PCA cares about variance, and it's going to order the components by decreasing variance. CCA doesn't care about variance, it cares about correlation with the other set. So the first canonical correlate derived from your first set is the linear combination of your data, that this set of data has maximal correlation with the other one. And the first canonical correlate of the other set, it's vice versa. So they come by pairs, these things.
So these first CCs don't necessarily correlate well with each other?
They do.
Well, it doesn't sound like it from that, so I said not necessarily.
So
is there a reason why we expect
Yes, so once you've found the best component derived from A to maximize the correlation, its projection on the other set, I believe, will be a linear combination of the other set that has the equal correlation to the first set. So yeah, there is a reason why they should be the same. So in our case, first set is audio, second is EEG. So what is it, what CCA is doing, it's going to be, and this is why it's useful, it's going to strip the EEG of all the activity that's unrelated to sound. And it's going to strip the sound of everything that is not predictive of EEG. That's a useful thing. So it projects both into a common space. And the nice thing is that it's going to produce multiple guesses. There's the best guess and the second best and so on. So I'll illustrate this with some data that we borrowed from Ed Lalor's group. It was recorded by Giovanni Di Liberto. So the stimulus was an audiobook of somebody reading The Old Man and the Sea.
in the Gulf Stream, and you've gone 84 days now without taking a fish. In the first 40
So the subjects were sitting there with the earphones on their head, listening to this, while the signals were being recorded from their brain.
Which is the worst form of
The audio, the pre-processing for the audio was simply to take the envelope, square, low pass, square root, downsample to the same sampling rate as the EEG. Pre-processing for the EEG was a bunch of, denoising, standard denoising steps. We took these data and we applied CCA. And so there's, when you do this kind of stuff, that there's always a doubt as to whether you have the proper alignment, because you're dealing with, well, the brain has some latency and you're applying filters and time lags and stuff. So it's very easy to get it wrong. So the easiest way to address this issue is to simply repeat the calculation several times at different relative time lags of the, so you shift the audio relative to the EEG. And the evaluation is simply by looking at the cross-correlation coefficients. And the significance of any difference that we see is tested by cross-validation. So this is the sort of thing that you see. So for comparison, we can look at what the forward model, simple forward model would do, the simple backward model, and CCA. So forward and backward in this configuration, essentially there's only one dimension of comparison. So we have a single curve here. And we get values the best for this overall time shift. So this axis here is the overall time shift between the audio and the EEG. And here's the sweet spot here, quite close to zero. The best correlation here is around 0.1. It's a little less here. With CCA, we get correlation coefficients. So first, we get multiple coefficients. And the values that we get are much, much higher. So why are they higher? It's a combination of the fact that the CCA operation is throwing away garbage. It's also that it is optimizing all these things, like whether it's high pass or low pass, or it's really finding the best possible ways of rotating your data to maximize the correlation.
And from the standpoint of like science, is the advantage here that the power is increased because of this?
What do you call power?
In most cases, you get a bump, right? But would your ability to detect a signal of interest, for a given amount of data be greater if you're using?
So in our task, which is classification, so we want to make a decision between two or multiple possibilities, that would be our criterion. Now, if the question is, does a better score here translate automatically into a better score for our classification? The answer is not necessarily, and there are reasons for that. I think that Danielle is going to organize a discussion group precisely on this kind of issue, on the issues of brain decoding and classification.
That's also my question, basically. How does the signal to noise ratio change? That's at the end what you're interested in for the decoding problem, more or less, right? So maybe
the signal
correlation goes up, but if it just scales, then it doesn't help you, right?
It is complicated by the fact that so here this indicates that the signal to noise ratio has gone up. Now, is this sufficient? Not necessarily, because of the fact that the corresponding components are actually, we're going to see it in an instant, they're actually relatively low-pass filtered, meaning that they have more serial correlation than the original signal, meaning that their discriminative power is actually reduced. So it's not necessarily the case that we're going to get better decoding simply because we have a better correlation. But Danielle will explain that more.
So the correlation assumes that the relation is linear, right?
Yes.
Is it? Because I know my experience is that if you play a little bit with compressions, expansions, you can get higher. If you want to get high correlation, you get a higher correlation.
So we can tweak things like applying a compression like the square, power compression to the envelope and stuff like that. Okay. It affects it slightly.
Would it make some sense to use something which is not so sensitive to distance, like mutual information? Because that's what you are after, right? You try to find if there is any relation between EEG and acoustics.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we would apply it in this context, in the sense that the mutual information requires estimating the probability distribution and stuff. I mean, that means it's data. So, there are good reasons to use linear methods as far as possible. Nonlinear dependencies can be treated within exactly the same framework by throwing them in the input. Mm-hmm. So if you think that half-wave rectification might help, you just throw it in as additional channels and you let CC.
So you're saying if the correlation goes up, the mutual information would go up too, and you are interested in how
not necessarily.
It goes up.
Yeah. So here's just an example of comparing the prediction and the two canonical coordinates. So how does this translate in terms of classification? So the task here was to based on those data, so we took a chunk of speech, a chunk of EEG, and the task was to say whether this chunk of EEG and audio matched, or whether they were taken from some other time. The features were, the correlation coefficients, classifier. The parameter here is the duration of the data over which we measure. And so here, these curves here are for forward model, backward model. This is what you get if you apply CCA and you do the classification based on all the canonical components. And this is what you do if you apply even smarter techniques that help increase these are things that Daniel will talk about.
Sorry, but what are these different canonical components? So the first one is if you iterate this procedure once.
Next slide. So each canonical correlate involves an FIR filter that is applied to the wave, to the envelope, okay? So an FIR filter applied to the envelope it's working in the modulation domain. So it's a modulation filter. And it just so happens that if you look at them, they look like bandpass filters.
So what is that they are passing if it is like half hertz?
It's slow fluctuations of the signal. Slightly less slow and so on.
What would be in the signal? Half hertz? Would it be some pauses between speech or something?
I didn't go back to the speech to.
It changes every 2 seconds, right?
Well, I mean, there are components that are at each of these.
It's a very slow topper.
Right, that would be a really slow.
So one hertz
some
is.
Some of them are higher,
So this is one hertz. So this guy peaks at about one third of
a
hertz.
But this one is a high.
So it's about 3 seconds. Right? 3 second.
It's the highest correlation.
This is actually the highest correlation.
Yeah, so that's why I'm asking. I mean, because all the lower ones are really enhancing something like almost like maybe some artifact in the data.
But you get good correlations. I mean, that artifact in the data is predictive of the EEG.
Yeah, so artifact might be that you have a pause between the sounds or something. I mean,
don't forget that lower frequencies are more prevalent to both the EEG.
I know, but what is the half hertz there, right?
But it is actually makes sense from the perspective of whole sentences. So I guess you have a few words per second, right, in speech, and then a few words split one sentence, so then you can get less than one
quite
word.
A lot,
And so between sentences, you might often have breaks.
Oh, that's what I mean.
I'm not quite sure, but that's how it sounds like. So the onsets have very strong responses, but they might happen at the beginning of a sentence.
You heard what the speech sounded like.
You don't have many pauses between words. I mean, but you have certainly pauses when you take a breath or something. What is it? We don't know.
But the remarkable thing, so is it a quirk? Is it not a quirk? I don't know. But it looks very, very much like a modulation filter bank. And each of these things, so this is the filter that is applied to the stimulus. Mm-hmm. Each of these is associated with a spatiotemporal filter applied to the EEG. So we can't plot a spatiotemporal filter, but we can plot the spatial approximation. And you can see that each of these has some kind of topography that is, well, some of them are a little bit similar, others are distinct. So,
to what extent do the higher number of components actually contribute to the predictive power? Is there like a spectrum or something?
It's not proportional to correlation coefficient. So, for example, in the you had examples where coefficients out here were actually almost the most discriminant. So it's you can have high correlation but not very good discriminability, and lower correlation but actually better discriminability. And that has to do with serial correlation.
Oh, sorry, I was asking a different question. If you just redo the analysis but throw CC12 out, do the results actually change? You know what I mean? CC1 is the most important.
Yeah.
And choose the second most important. So presumably, by the time you get to the end, they're not actually doing much anymore. Or is that not true?
I mean, the correlation coefficient between for example, for component 12, between the thing derived from EEG and the thing derived from stimulus, I mean, well, the correlation is weaker. Yeah.
But a lot or a little. I'm just wondering whether we should really interpret this modulation filter bank as meaningful.
I mean, certainly I think the components are meaningful. So each component, the fact that you have multiple components means that you have different things going on. They don't all have the same time course, and they don't all have the same brain topography. There are multiple things going on. This you can say. Now, yeah.
Yes, maybe one way to get at that would be without that canonical correlation analysis, like go back, divide your speech signal into these different frequency bands, extract the power correlation, and see what is the predictive power of that. Say without the spatial component of the filter, but with the temporal components.
Yeah.
Would that give similar predictive power?
Yeah, we could try that. We could also leave things out here. We'll reduce the number that we keep and see what the impact is. So anyhow, to summarize this bit, CCA gives us a rich information on the brain processes. So we have a tool to observe multiple things going on at the same time. So multiple cortical activity with different spatial temporal signatures, and that are associated with speech component on different multiple time scales. So that's nice. And it gives good features for decoding, because we get high correlation scores and we have several of them. So that means that we can design a classifier that has a higher dimension to work on. So I'm going to move from, how am I doing in time?
So I just wanted to say the time is basically up.
Okay, so.
But you could also decide if you go longer, I don't know. Like.
Well, I don't want to eat into Josh's time.
Yeah. We could move everything backward, but we can also stay on schedule.
It's your call.
Well, shall we move on?
How much longer do you have for your third part?
Let's move on. I can give the rest.
You can find some other time.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for that.